From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Tracy Wilkinson, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro reporter for the Associated Press, and our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. A sharp rise in the coronavirus case raises questions about just when the virus will be brought under control. Bernie Sanders wins the Democratic primary in New Hampshire as the race for that party's presidential nomination moves into high gear. U.S. President Donald Trump's post-impeachment purge continues, and there are questions as to whether he influenced the judicial process in the sentencing of an old friend and the former president of Sudan, and a remarkable development will be tried for war crimes. Well, let's start with this coronavirus. Obviously, one big story that the entire world is watching. The number of cases, China says, has actually surged in the last couple of days. That's because they apparently have changed the methodology by which they're diagnosing this illness. But this is more than a health story, of course. It's also an economic story because it has slowed China's supply chain, which the rest of the world depends on. It's also a political story, the ability of President Xi Jinping to control an eternal crisis. Ashraf Khalil, we'll start with you. Good to see you. What, out of all of these factors, what really is the most important thing in your view? What stands out?
Inside China, it stands to reason you're going to get pressure to prove that they can handle this. Just recently, I binge-watched the HBO miniseries Chernobyl, like stayed up super late. And so it's kind of on my mind of this. You had this government in crisis trying to prove they were on top of things that was even a higher, that was almost a higher priority than handling the problem. And eventually it gets so big that you can't keep it going. But yeah, you would imagine there's dual pressures to get it done and prove they can get it done. And certainly there's going to be a pressure to maybe shine up the results a little bit.
And what do you think, Tracy, out of all these factors?
You know, they're doing a little better job than they did during the SARS epidemic. At least they are acknowledging that this is happening, but it is a big political problem and a big economic problem. I think, you know, when you have the second largest economy in the world slowing down this way and being hurt, damaged, that's going to have, as you said, an impact worldwide. Politically, you know, Xi, it's been a mixed bag. You know, we've seen some of the initial doctors who initially denounced this were prisoned, silenced. One has died from the disease. Some of the so-called citizen journalists, people who were filming and putting this stuff on the news on social media, have disappeared. So Xi is really in a bind of, as Ashraf said, proving he can handle it, but also the Chinese way of doing things, which is keeping things controlled and relatively silent. But they are acknowledging thousands and thousands of cases and deaths. So, you know, at least there's that.
We were just talking before the taping, in fact, Ashraf, about you brought up a very good point about Chernobyl, the Soviet example in 1986 when that nuclear reactor melted down. They tried to cover it up. In fact, you made a good point that kind of managing the cover-up might have been, in fact, even more important than actually controlling the crisis itself. Are we seeing that kind of dynamic at play in China, do you think?
It's hard to say from the outside, but certainly the pressures are going to be there. The temptation to skew that way on the part of any government is going to be there. So you can only hope that accuracy is of real crucial importance in something like this, medical accuracy. It's not a PR problem. Yeah.
What do you, and Tracy, what do you think that says about sort of China in general, that they're, to me, it's a sign of insecurity when you have to cover something up? I think one thing that I think of is sort of after the, speaking of 1986 in Chernobyl, when the space shuttle Challenger exploded that year, President Reagan went on television and said, oh, this is what we do in an open democracy. We don't hide our faults. We put it out in the open. It makes us stronger. That is not the case in China. What does that say in your view about sort of the way the communist system runs things there?
Not just the communist system, but an authoritarian system. Where there isn't democracy and there isn't the security of freedom of information that at least until recently, was certainly the tradition here in the United States. It says that as large as China is becoming, as big an influence as it has become on the world stage, it still has a lot of these sort of old-fashioned tendencies that are part of authoritarianism, that where they don't have the security to be forthright with their problems.
And what do you think going forward? What can we expect in the coming days? What do you think?
Well, I do think, as I mentioned, they are being a little more open about this than they were, say, with the SARS virus several years ago. You know, the World Health Organization is involved. The Centers for Disease Prevention and Control in the United States is involved. So a lot of the world agencies are involved. So I do think that there will be a lot of care taken. The danger, what I'm seeing here in the United States, is an overreaction sometimes that you see, in fact, overt racism coming. You know, a Chinese person is seen in L.A., for example, and they're feared as being potential carriers. So I think we do need to have a lot more education about what the disease really is in, you know, on this side of the world.
Well, let's move on to here in the United States, the first primary of the 2020 presidential election has been held. And the winner on the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders, he is a 78-year-old self-described a socialist from the tiny state of Vermont, but his win was not as convincing as it was 4 years ago, and kind of nipping at his heels was someone far younger, this 38-year-old former mayor of a smallish town in the Midwest, Pete Buttigieg, and also Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, a woman. She had a rather impressive showing as well. It seems to me that it's a little too early to say that to anybody is the front runner at this point.
Well, a little behind the curtain, at a recent staff news meeting at the Associated Press, somebody used the term Klobuchar to describe the momentum to mass groaning all around the room. So she's definitely regarded as, you know, having finished a surprising third. She seemed to come on strong. She seemed to be a strong debater. That seemed to have an immediate impact on her. So it's interesting. She survived the great winnowing. I mean, of all of them, I think people thought Buttigieg would be here. I don't know that people 2 months ago, 3 months ago, thought she'd be one of these last people standing. But now I think you're down to this group probably isn't going anywhere for a while. But I mean, I'm a Super Tuesday guy. Like, this is all very interesting. And the people in New Hampshire and Iowa seem to take their responsibilities very seriously. But demographics of America. I want more states.
Well, to our global listeners, explain what Super Tuesday is. We have listeners all around the world. What is Super Tuesday?
It's multiple primaries around the country, and that's going to be the first time in this process that you're going to get large representation and large voting blocks of non-white Americans.
Right, because Iowa and New Hampshire are very small states that are very white.
And skew older.
And so it's not really representative of the entire United States. And so we need to see these next states coming up. You know, Joe Biden, who everyone thought would be a front runner, or the front runner, you know, has fallen. I think he came in fifth in New Hampshire, which is bad, you know, very bad. And so he's looking to the next states where there are more black voters, more Latino voters, and hoping that he can finally win a primary.
Well, I was going to ask about that. I mean, the next state, obviously, is Nevada, large numbers of Hispanics, South Carolina, large numbers of black voters. Biden seems to be, his campaign may come down to his performance in those two states. It's not just Biden. There was another person from a couple of months ago who seemed to be sort of at or near the top not too long ago, Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts. Both of them fizzled in both Iowa and New Hampshire. I guess the question for either of you is, how long can either of them hang on?
That's a good question. One concern that I think the Democratic Party leadership has is that Sanders may be too far left in the U.S. context for a general election win, you know, to be able to defeat Trump. And so I'm a little confused about why Sanders and Warren, Elizabeth Warren, have very similar policies, why she faded and he didn't. I don't really, that's not been explained to me, but that is certainly what has happened. He has surged and she has faded. It's unclear. She's insisting, you know, there's still, you know, 98% of the country needs to speak, but she is fading and it will be hard, you know, for her to sustain the fundraising and any kind of momentum to continue. Biden still has such a, you know, an organization and name recognition. I wouldn't count him out, but I think Elizabeth Warren is struggling.
What is the attraction of these top through the Klobuchar, which is a great line, notwithstanding. Sanders is 78 years old. He calls himself socialist. Poll after poll after poll says Americans don't want to elect a socialist, and yet here he is. Explain the attraction that a lot of people seem to have for him, also for Buttigieg and for Klobuchar. Dive a little bit deeper, if you could.
Well, I think the attraction of Sanders is one thing, and the attraction of Buttigieg and Klobuchar is the other. Sanders is the extreme in American politics, which says a lot about American politics, but also, the fact that he says, for my generation, and I think the generation before it as well, the word socialism was this taboo. You know, that just says a lot about the American mindset, that it was regarded as this halfway to communism thing. And the fact that he's out there talking about it, and the fact that he's got AOC just talking about socialism in a very normal way, is groundbreaking in America in a way that probably people outside America might not see, that the word socialism is such a charged word here in a way that it's not in other places. Buttigieg and Klobuchar, they're representing now the middle. If Biden is faltering, they represent the new, that we are the people who actually have a chance to win this. We are moderates. You know, they're going to argue that Sanders and Warren are just too far out there. And as far as where everybody's going, Tracy mentioned something very important. It's not just the media stuff. It's not just the votes. It's the fundraising. You know, we tend to talk about politics like it's sports, where it's like, oh, these people have momentum and these people are charging and these people are getting up and these people are losing steam. It's the money. If you're not consistently finishing well, the money dries up.
They'll call money the mother's milk of politics for nothing, do they? Well, let's pause for a short break. More issues in the news in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Tracy Wilkinson, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro reporter for the Associated Press, and our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today.
Welcome back. Four federal prosecutors have withdrawn from a case against Roger Stone. He's a longtime confidant of President Trump. Stone is also a convicted felon and had been facing 7 to 9 years in prison, but now is facing apparently just a fraction of that. There's speculation, Tracy, that this is because the president let it be known on Twitter that he thought the sentencing guidelines for Stone, 7 to 9 years. He thought that was bogus. In fact, he thought the whole case against Stone to begin with was a sham.
Yes, he did. And there's some dispute over the timing of all of this, but President Trump definitely let it be known via Twitter that he thought the sentence was excessive, was unfair, before we knew it, announcing that
the Attorney General William Barr
announcing that, well, in fact, they would revise the sentence recommendation. And in response, four of the prosecutors involved withdrew from the case. One quit the Justice Department altogether. Ultimately, it will be up to the judge to sentence Stone, but this did have the appearance of political influence, although Barr has since denied that, but did have the appearance that Trump was, you know, asking for lenient treatment for a friend of his, an ally.
Now we're going to talk more about Barr in just a second for some other reasons, but, you know, Ashraf, this follows the president's tweeting. The timing, of course, not quite certain, but it does follow some things that we do know. The president also sacked a highly decorated war veteran, of course, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who had testified against the president in his recent impeachment trial. Also fired was Vindman's brother. Ironically enough, he was an ethics lawyer mm-hmm. on the National Security Council staff. The president appears to be kind of getting back at some of his critics here.
Yeah, getting back in a way that really kind of seems like
he doesn't care about the optics of it, doesn't care about how it looks. It is rather blatant, and it is something we've seen before in politics, but you have to go back to Nixon, and where these sort of like vendettas through the government, it's an indication of how things are going to go. The next year is going to be a wild ride.
And for our listeners around the world who are looking at all this and asking what's going on, it's fair to point out there's a lot of commentary to the effect that these kind of things traditionally do not happen in the United States. The president does not get involved in law enforcement cases. He does not meddle, as some have said he's doing, in Department of Justice cases. But he, as you say, Ashraf, the optics of it perhaps don't seem to matter to him. What do you make of that?
Well, it is pretty remarkable. As you say, these are not things that traditionally happen in the United States. There are three branches of government. They're supposed to stay separate, executive, judicial, and legislative. And we have seen repeatedly the president, you know, he busts norms right and left. And since the impeachment trial ended, he has taken after the witnesses. This was Vindman and others. We had a story this week where it shows that he has, or at least they have been fired or removed about a third of the National Security Council, many of whom were people that Trump did not like. Trump does not like being given advice on foreign affairs or security matters, and so he is cutting down his national security staff, which is also quite remarkable. Overseas, we are seeing political appointee ambassadors firing their deputy chiefs of mission, the number two person at the embassy, just because they don't like them. Again, they have a right to do that, but it's just not done traditionally. These are political appointees who don't like the career foreign service people. This week, the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, refused to promise to Congress that he would avoid political influence from President Trump in imposing sanctions on foreign governments. So everywhere we are seeing evidence that President Trump is trying to influence areas of government that traditionally a president does not do.
And this breaking down of a barrier, some people say, because you mentioned, Tracy, that we've always had from the very beginning, very founding of this country, separation of powers, three branches of government. And let's name them again. You said there's the executive branch, that's the president. There's the legislature, that's the Congress. Then there's the judiciary, Supreme Court, and so forth. And the president seems to just blur them all together for his own ends. I think it's fair to say that. And there are some critics, Ashraf, who say that this is really, again, something we don't see in this country traditionally, yet it's happening now. Is it too much to say that the rule of law in this country, I can't believe I'm asking this, but is the rule of law in the United States eroding? Big question.
Potentially. And one of the other things that's happening is through the president's many, many public statements, faith in the agencies is eroding. Faith in the instruments is eroding. He's done a lot to undermine the reputation of the FBI and the CIA. And, you know, when he talks about the deep state and all of this. So the faith in the institutions is eroding. And I think one of the things here that you're seeing is that President Trump values loyalty above all else, and he expects loyalty from people, individuals, and agencies that are not supposed to, their top loyalty is not supposed to be personally to the president.
I mean, it's almost like, and there's been plenty of writing about this in the last couple of years, but in a way, he sort of acts like he was for most of his life, the CEO of a privately held company where, of course, you can do whatever you want and you can fire people at will. But the United States government is very different to animal. And the sense is he doesn't quite understand that he's in a very different ecosystem. Now, he doesn't understand or perhaps appreciate it.
Right. He doesn't understand it or doesn't choose to understand it. There was a joke said by a Republican early on that, you know, President Trump arrives and says, what? Three branches of government? Who knew? You know, he thinks it's all him. And that's how he has always run his enterprise. And to echo Ashraf, not just faith in the institutions is eroding, but faith in truth and in facts. Press is now the enemy of the people, according to President Trump. And so I think the public no longer has a kind of shared consensus of, you know, basic facts and basic reality. And that is something that I think the president has managed to erode as well.
Adding to all of this were some highly unusual comments by, you mentioned Bill Barr, the attorney general, of course, the top law enforcement officer in this country, who said that Trump's public comments meddling in cases like the Stone case, he says it makes it, quote, impossible, unquote, for him to do his job. Barr says, and I'm quoting again here, quote, I think it's time to stop this tweeting about Department of Justice criminal cases. Now, the president, surprisingly, who comes down like a ton of bricks on anyone who so much looks at him sideways, says, well, I'm not bothered by these comments from my attorney general. What do you make of that, Ashraf?
Well, I would imagine it must be really interesting to be Donald Trump's attorney general. I'm going to wait to see if this is some sort of schism with Barr. I kind of feel like he had to say this, and this is kind of something, the tone of Barr's comments was something you get from a lot of Trump deputies and underlings, where they're just like, they're not questioning the man, they're not questioning they're not even really questioning the judgment, they're just going, oh gosh, you know, I kind of wish he wouldn't go on the tweet storms, but oh well, that's what you get. And it's like, it's not a real, he's not really bothered by it. It's an inconvenience on the way to somewhere. And I think that's a tone you get with a lot of Trump deputies.
What do you make of it, Tracy?
Yeah, I agree. I think we have to be a little skeptical. Let's see. I mean, if the tweets really make it impossible for him to do his job, he would resign. Right. And so we have to see what comes of this. It does seem a little well-timed, a little suspicious. Barr was coming under such criticism for an apparent lack of independence. He might have felt he had to save face a little bit. And for Trump not to come down on him suggests that perhaps this was prearranged. We just have to wait and see.
Well, I remember that Trump's first attorney general, Jeff Sessions, the former senator from Alabama, Trump sort of came down on him when Sessions kind of distanced himself a little bit from what the White House was doing. So,
right. Trump never forgave him for recusing himself from the Russia investigation and trashed Sessions incessantly. And
daily.
Daily. And Sessions kept on until
kind of hounded him out of office. Well, we've got just about a minute or so left here. And there's one other story that I wanted to get here. We go to Africa for that. The former president of Sudan is going to be tried in The Hague for war crimes or alleged war crimes, I suppose. Tracy, give us the story.
Well, this is Omar al-Bashir, the former president of the Sudan. Tens of thousands of people died or were killed in Darfur. You may remember in the early, I guess, 2000s. And he continued to serve as president until fairly recently, finally being overthrown, and was never brought to justice. You know, people were killed, civilians killed, starved to death, rampant disease, you know, as a result of the killings and the famine. And so finally, he's going to be sent to the International Criminal Court, which is remarkable. You know, you've seen so many terrible tyrants over the years who escape any kind of justice. And I think of the Bosnia War, and, you know, some of those officials did end up at The Hague.
I was just thinking of Slobodan Milosevic,
Karadzic, Radovan Karadzic. And so it's me, as someone who cares about justice in the world, I'm always heartened when I do see someone like this sent to the Hague for a trial, a fair trial. Evidence will be presented and a prosecution and a defense, but it doesn't happen as much as it should, I think. And so I think we should, you know, really take note when it does.
Well, it's quite a big case, obviously, and we'll have to keep an eye on it in the weeks and months ahead. We'll have to end it right there. Boy, the time flies by here, doesn't it? Our thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Ashraf Khalil of the Associated Press and Tracy Wilkinson. She is with the Los Angeles Times. Good to see you both, and thanks for coming. This program was produced by Kim Lewis, our engineer Justin Thwaites, and I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports in USA Today. Thanks for joining us.